Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined by Brad C. Hodson, and we are talking about the 2019 Pet Sematary reboot, remake, whatever you want to call it. But Brad, how are you doing today?
Not too bad. Just fighting off a little cold, so excuse me if I cough a bit.
No worries at all, but I think, you know, we'll just dive right on in here. For you, was this movie something that you saw in theaters when it came out? Was it something you waited for the home release? What's your sort of viewing experience with this, if you will?
It was one I wanted to see in the theater, and for various reasons, I just missed it. So as soon as it was, I think the first weekend it was available on a home release, I watched it at home.
Okay. I went and saw this in theaters, and I watched it again for the podcast. So I've seen it a couple times now, and I just want to say I probably overhyped this when I went to go see it in theaters. I think I was just excited that there was more Stephen King stuff coming out in theaters because we had had It and, you know, It Chapter 2 was the same year as this one. And obviously you had the Netflix stuff like Gerald's Game 1922 and In the Tall Grass, but, you know, It and Pet Sematary are two of my favorite King stories. So I was especially excited for those two things. And, you know, on rewatch, I don't think this one held up quite as well. I didn't feel the same about it as I did the first time.
I'm glad you said that. I'm right there with you. Pet Sematary is one of my favorite novels of King's. I've read it probably three times. I'll say this, it's interesting going back and revisiting some of this stuff after having kids, because I tried to reread Pet Sematary on audiobook before the movie came out, but it was the first time I had tried to read it after having children, and I got to the point in the book where I think it's Lewis and Gage are flying a kite out in a field, and, you know, it's just this great, like, father-son moment, and at the end of the chapter, Stephen King does that Stephen King foreboding that he does so well, and just straight up says Gage would be dead in 3 months. And I was like, nope, I can't deal with this. I was like, you know, I have a son the exact same age as Gage. I don't want to hear about this anymore. And it's funny how books do that in a way that movies don't. Like, I can watch brutal movies and it doesn't hit me on that same level as when you're reading a book. I guess it's because you're creating so much of the imagery. You know, your mind is putting so much of you into the book as you read it, that it works on you on a different level.
Right, because then your imagination is kind of running wild with it. You aren't being shown exactly what someone wants you to see. Instead, you kind of have that leeway to have your mind go to some wild places. But, you know, Pet Sematary is possibly my favorite ending in a King book.
Yes.
And it's just one of those ones where I absolutely loved it when I read it. And from what I can tell, neither movie uses the ending, really. They end in different ways. And, you know, they did do a lot of stuff to change up the story, at least, you know, a little bit with this one. But first, I want to talk about the cast, because you have Jason Clarke in the lead as Lewis Creed, Amy Simetz, John Lithgow, Jete Lawrence, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, but, you know, then you have twins, Hugo and Louis Lavoy, playing Gage. But really, you know, you have some appearances from Victor Pascal, who is played by Absa Ahmed, and Alyssa Brooke Levine playing Zelda. And then you kind of have Rachel's parents pop in for, like, 30 seconds. So this is a very small cast. And I do want to say that, you know, the girl who plays Ellie definitely made her very creepy. Like, that was probably the performance I was impressed with the most out of this.
That's probably the strongest thing it has going for it, is the cast. And even, you know, I mean, I've always loved John Lithgow's work, but Fred Gwynne in the 89 adaptation has just kind of become like an iconic character. I think he even shows up on South Park all the time. And so, you know, that's a hard performance to go up against. And I love the way that Lithgow played the role. And, you know, all the actors do a great job, especially in the first half of the movie, of getting you, making you feel like you live with these people, that you know them, that they're your neighbors, you know, that you could walk out the door and you could walk to Judd's house. You know, I feel like the actors really embody the characters during that first half really well.
Yeah, I think one of the main critiques I've seen as far as the casting goes is that Jason Clarke wasn't as, I guess, emotional and kind of charismatic as people were kind of hoping. He kind of played it a little flat. And on the second watch, I saw that a little more because he just sort of takes this very doctorly approach to things. And, you know, that definitely sticks out a little more for me on rewatch. Did you feel that at all?
Yeah. Like I said, I loved what everybody did in the first half of the movie. To me, so, I mean, obviously, I always feel like we should say spoiler alert, but
yes.
I'm sure anybody tuning in, like, you know.
I'm so bad at it, especially on the recent stuff. I've been trying to remember to do it, and I never do. Because, you know, when I started, I was talking about stuff from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and it's like, if you haven't seen or read this yet, like, you've had time.
Yeah. So, this takes a big deviation from the book, whereas in the book, the youngest child, Gage, is the one who dies, and everyone is dealing with that for the rest of the book. And in this, it's the older daughter, Ellie, who's killed. And at that point, for me, the movie kind of falls apart. And it's interesting because I was actually really excited about that. I'd heard about that twist before I went in to see it. And having read the book so many times and seeing the 89 adaptation, which is cheesy but has its good moments, I was kind of excited to see a different take on it. And so it wasn't the change that bothered me. It's just at the moment that they deviate from the source material, I feel like the movie loses itself. I never felt like the movie had a good reason to deviate from the source material other than trying to do something different. One of the things in the book that's so powerful and why you keep coming back to it, or I do anyway, is that it's a powerful book about loss and dealing with loss. Like, it is a very sad, emotional, gripping novel once Gage dies and you're dealing with that. And like you said, like the parents barely show up here, and they play a huge role in that, in making Lewis feel the guilt for his son dying, and just helping to drive Lewis to his lowest point. And we lose all of that in this. And I think part of it is Jason Clarke's performance, but I think it's just that I don't think that powerful grief was even there in the movie for him as an actor to play off of. Yeah.
I would completely agree with that. And where I think the deviation worked well was the fact that Ellie knew what was going on in a way that Gage never did in the book and in the first movie. So it had a different sort of creepiness to it because you could tell she was like thinking about what she was doing. Whereas with Gage, he really never felt that way in the original movie, for me at least, or in the book. And, you know, I did like that element to it, but like you said, it kind of just falls apart and the performances can't save it. Especially, you know, you can't really expect a kid to be able to save a movie necessarily, especially when you have people like Jason Clarke, Amy Simons, and John Lithgow surrounding this, you know, child character. And it just was so slow, too. It felt really slow on this watch. And I was like, I don't really know why I liked this the first time around. And that's not to say it was the worst thing. You and I have certainly talked about worse movies than this one. That is for sure.
Definitely.
I think there were some very well done shots in this, and you had some great imagery. The kids wearing those masks and beating the drum and, you know, walking in formation down the path to the pet cemetery. And there's stuff that definitely sticks with you imagery wise from this movie. But that's, again, not enough to save it.
Yeah, where this movie hits a home run for me is in the cinematography and the art direction. But yeah, like it's not enough to save it. And, you know, like you were saying, Ellie, the actress that plays Ellie has some great moments. But then it feels like they never really got a handle on what they wanted the tone to be once they make the change. And so there are points where she has these very kind of like cheesy one-liners, and it feels like kind of a pulpy straight to video zombie movie from the 90s or something. And then it'll snap back from that and try to be serious, and it just kind of like waffles back and forth and never really finds its footing once it makes that change. Which is a shame, because again, it has so much going for it. And that's something, you know, I tried not to think about the 89 version while watching this, or to compare it, because they're, you know, a lot of people call this a remake, but it's just another adaptation of the book. So I don't think it's fair to think of it in terms of a remake. But as far as adaptations from the same source material, whereas the original was low budget and kind of cheesy in parts and a little melodramatic, I do think that they leaned into the correct choice they made was to lean into the grief. And, you know, maybe the cast in that one wasn't up to snuff to entirely pull it off. Again, it kind of plays melodramatic sometimes, but that's what that movie's about. Like that, the 1989 understands that that's what the book's about. And so even when it misses, it's trying to hit on those same themes. And I never felt that this one did. I never felt that this one was trying even remotely to be about grief or these kind of like parental anxieties and things the way that the novel is. I felt that this one was just like, oh man, wouldn't it be creepy if people came back from the dead?
Right. And it really leaned more into Rachel's guilt than I expected, because she really, really lingers on the whole Zelda thing. And we get those same sort of scenes that, you know, we get in the book. And for me, it was just like, why is this grown woman being so weird now about this thing that happened in her childhood? And it didn't really make sense to me, honestly. It made more sense in the flow of the book. But here, it was like they were more concerned about that than the fact that they had a dead child.
Yeah. Yeah, it's again, once they make that change, like everything just kind of falls apart. It doesn't come together well in every aspect, from character motivation to, again, like the theme and the tone, and even the ending. I mean, you were saying that it's one of your favorite Stephen King endings in the book, and I absolutely agree. Like, that is such a creepy ending. for those of you listening who maybe haven't read the book in a while or haven't read it, the book ends. Lewis's wife, Rachel, has been killed. He's set Judd's house on fire, I believe, and has gotten rid of Gage. Daughter Ellie in that one is with her grandparents while all this is happening. And he takes Rachel to the pet cemetery. And then he comes back to his house, and he just sits on the floor in the kitchen, and he plays solitaire with his back to the door. And then it's all played through sound, even though it's on the page, where he hears the door open and he hears footsteps across the door and then across the floor. And then he just hears Rachel say, darling.
Yeah,
and then
so
that's it. And we don't know what happens. And it's so,
so
creepy.
Good.
And in the 89, they tried to pay a little respect to that, but they end up like showing her and she has a knife and obviously stabs him. And I think it like sucks the power out of it. In this one, they go completely different direction.
Yeah.
And the entire family gets buried in the pet cemetery while Gage is in the car. And then the murderous zombies come up to the 3-year-old in the car. And it just not only didn't work as well, but it just felt so like mean spirited. And I know that's a weird thing to say for horror stuff. Because that's, you know, again, like I'm down for like, you know, brutality and let's explore violence and the darker psychological bits and stuff. But it didn't feel like there was a point to that ending other than being like, hey, how shocking would this be that this 3-year-old's family are going to murder him? You know?
Yeah. Like, they didn't even crack the windows for him. How rude.
Yeah.
I was just like, how long has he been in this car? Because, you know, it takes at least a little while for them to come back. And he's just in the car the whole time. And you're like, well, I hope it's not all that hot out. And in the end, Gage is still the one you feel bad for, like you do in the book. But it doesn't have the same impact. And like you said, there were plenty of things to enjoy about this with the cinematography and the art direction. And, you know, I really loved the looks of both houses, you know, the Creed house and Judd's house. And they definitely recreated some scenes. They, you know, had the gore effect of Judd's, you know, Achilles basically being chopped. And I think, you know, there were some good things about this, but because of the changes they made, even though I was excited for them initially, they didn't really play out the way I was hoping. And, you know, I think when you have a cast this small and a story this contained, if one thing goes wrong, it can throw off the whole balance of the movie. And I think that's what happens here, because they leave out so much of the grief that makes this story what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you said, with a small cast, especially, I think that there's a need for intimacy. We need to be closer to these people. We need to be further into their lives. We need to be more into their heads. And it never happens. And so any of the pathos that we should have for the Creed family when they lose their daughter is gone. It's just not there. And if you don't have that emotional hook, not that you don't understand, you can logically work it out, but you don't feel like Lewis burying the kid in the pet cemetery is a logical step for him. It's like, yes, I understand. This is what Lewis would be doing. And if you're not there with him, if you don't understand how broken of a person he is when this happens, everything just falls apart. It doesn't work after that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I was a little bummed rewatching this, because the first time I watched it, I believe I gave it like a 3.5 out of 5, which I didn't think it was spectacular or anything like that. But I thought I had a good time with it, at least. You know, maybe I was just excited to be watching it in the theater. But this time I was like, okay, you kind of see the cracks in all of it, especially after having read the book, watched the 89 one, and, you know, even watching Pet Sematary 2, which has its own problems, but is also very quirky and, you know, at least has Clancy Brown in it. You have sort of over the top performances with those first two Pet Sematary movies. And this, it was like played down a lot, in my opinion. I think for me, Rachel got annoying because she like wouldn't let Lewis talk to Ellie about any sort of death or talk to her about church or anything like that, because it made her think of Zelda. And then you just kind of had this repeating thing with Zelda, 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 Zelda from Rachel. And it just felt like it put the character into a box that she could not get out of the entire movie.
Yeah. Yeah, which is such a shame, because in the book especially, Rachel's such a well-rounded character and has so much going on and makes a lot of really interesting, strong choices in the book. I mean, again, like when she comes back in the book, she leaves Ellie with her parents. And here she brings Gage with her. And that was the first thing I was like, why would you do that? like anything that's going on, I'm not going to bring my children into any situation where I feel weird or where they can see mommy and daddy fight. You know, I mean, there's just all these things where it's like, why not leave him with the grandparents? Oh, so that we can have the very mean-spirited ending that they thought would be shocking. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree on that point too. And, you know, I was also like, okay, the parents still live in the house where Zelda died. And that alone is a little strange, given how traumatic that seemed to be. And, you know, there's no avoiding Zelda for Rachel this entire time, even when she's not at her parents' house. And I don't know, the second time around, it just really bothered me how much they leaned into that and just failed epically to lean into, hey, you lost a child.
Yeah, the Zelda stuff in the book always read to me as like kind of buried memories for Rachel that come bubbling out as she's dealing with her grief. And in this, it's, yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, we lost a daughter, but let me talk about my sister I've been obsessed with for 30 years.
And it's like the whole thing with Zelda comes up when the cat dies, not when their daughter dies.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It comes up before that. And, you know, it's why she doesn't want Lewis to tell Ellie about church. And it's just so, so strange. I was like, this is really getting to me this time. But, you know, I really did like the look of this, the setting. They do a very nice job with the locations, with even just how the houses are set up for both the Creeds and for Judd. You know, you have Judd, who still has pictures of Norma out, and you can tell his place is a little more lonely, and you have the Creeds sort of still getting settled in, so things are kind of a little all over the place at the beginning for them, because obviously you gotta unpack and do all that fun stuff when you move. But I think even the Victor Pascal thing, it didn't hit the same way.
Yeah, there's a lot of this tonally that kind of robs it of power. I mean, again, so in the book, when we get to the end and it's Gage who's resurrected, we have this kind of like heart-wrenching moment where Lewis realizes he, you know, even though he went through all this to bring his dead son back, he has to kill him. And so he injects him with some kind of drug. I don't remember exactly. But it's kind of a sad scene, even though it's horrifying. In this, instead, we have a zombie fight in the cemetery.
And he drugs Judd.
Yeah, and like people are fighting with like shovels and weather vanes, and like it again, it's just tonally kind of all over the map, and so it never really comes together. Like that could have been a fun movie. Like if you reverse engineer Pet Cemetery from that moment, you're like, uh-huh, okay, we want to end with a zombie fight in the cemetery, and you reverse engineer it. You could make that movie, and that would be a fun movie, but that's not the movie that we watched for an hour before getting to that point.
Yeah, I think that would have been more interesting, and we don't even really get that sort of camaraderie between Judd and Lewis like I feel like you do in the book, and especially with him and the kids and everything like that. You know, Judd becomes very much ingrained in their life, if I'm not mistaken, in the book. And yeah, here he's just like the nosy kind of creepy old neighbor at first, and you're like,
Yeah, he becomes in the book kind of like a surrogate grandfather for the kids. And even the 89 version, I think, nailed that. I don't know if maybe that was just better chemistry between the actors.
Could have been.
Or if they spent more time developing it. But yeah, like that relationship's kind of important too, because Judd knows about the Pet Cemetery. He knows firsthand about the Pet Cemetery. Why would he ever tell anyone about this? And he does it not only because he's friends with Lewis, but he loves kids so much, he doesn't want to see them go through this with the loss of their cat. And so he's like, okay, I'm going to take you to the Pet Cemetery. And it's just a much stronger motivation that we don't really get here. There's just this kind of sense of like, why the hell is Judd telling him about the Pet Cemetery and taking him there? Like, why would he do that? It doesn't make any sense, because he knows what's going to happen. You know?
Yeah. And honestly, I'm kind of struggling for more things to say about this one, because yeah, it's better than some of the other stuff I've talked about, like Cell and some other movies. But I feel like because some of those other movies were so bad, we had a lot more to talk about as far as how they could improve those movies. Whereas this one, it was just, like you said, totally all over the place. And could it have been better? Yeah, of course. We already have proof that a version of a Pet Cemetery movie can be better. And I think this one just had a big misstep by wanting to change things up a little too much, and the whole second half of the movie pretty much suffered for it.
Yeah, I think there were two competing movies in here. And I know this had been, this remake had been in development for 10 or 12 years. They've been trying to do another Pet Sematary.
Which is a long time.
Yeah, so I mean, who knows how many scripts this has gone through, and they probably pulled elements of different versions of it together. This had, I think, two directors on it, so it's possible maybe they had competing visions, or you had studio interference. I read a review of this that it was talking about how cringy it was that the studio PR person was trying to pitch it as elevated horror, and just, you know, mostly how the reviewer hated that phrase, elevated horror, which I'm in agreement with. But they said, it might have been NPR's interview or review of it, but they said that it felt to them like this version was fast-tracked after Hereditary was a success. And so they were trying to capitalize on Hereditary. And if you think of it in that terms, it makes a lot of sense because it's kind of structured and paced like Hereditary. Like, we're going to be really slow and then have crazy shocking stuff at the end. It's just, you know, in Hereditary that all the crazy shocking stuff is an outgrowth of what we've sat through the whole time leading up to it. And in this, it's not. It, again, feels like a different movie that we just suddenly walked into. And that's always a shame to me when they do that with King. Again, I'm 100% down for changing the source material. I think we talked about this in the Dark Tower episode. It's like, I was excited hearing about how they were changing it because it's like, oh, that could be really cool and interesting. And then, of course, like, they fall on their face. And King's a writer who, you know, even with his faults, like he nails the story. So if you're going to change things, you have to have a good reason for it. You can't just change it to change it. And I think that's where a lot of these adaptations fall on their face, is they don't have a good reason for changing it other than, hey, let's do something different because this is very popular and people are going to know what the ending is.
And frankly, I think why some of these adaptations fail is because they don't make us like the characters.
Yeah, which is what King is an expert at.
Yes.
By the time the horror takes over in any of his books, you absolutely love the characters you're hanging out with. Even if it's people you hate, you love to hate them.
You really hate them.
Yeah. You know, that might be his biggest strength as a writer. And if you can't nail that in a King adaptation, then it's not going to work at all.
Yeah. That's definitely something that is very, very important to get across. And I think, you know, some of my favorite adaptations have really done that. Like, I love the 2017 It because I believe all of those kids are friends with each other and care about each other, you know?
Yeah, that's a great example of making big changes, but it works. Because it might be the biggest Stephen King movie that deviates the most from the source material, but they had a reason for almost every one of the changes. A couple of them get weird. Like, I love the 2017 one, but I'm always watching it being like, why did you take all the stuff that the black kid did and give it to the white kid in 2017? That seems like a weird choice.
Yeah, I talked about that for sure. I was like, you took all of Mike's stuff and gave it to the new kid, Ben. And okay, yeah, that doesn't really track with what we know of Mike's character later, but
Beverly's such a great character, and she kind of just becomes a damsel in distress, which, again, I thought it's weird for 2017. But even with that stuff aside, like, the movie works.
Yeah, because you like all of those kids for varying reasons. And, you know, same with Stand By Me and some of the others where you especially have kid characters, preteen characters, teenage characters, whatever, and you just get attached to them. But in this, you never really get attached to Ellie. You don't get attached to Gage, and you definitely don't get attached to Judd in the same way that I think you do in the book. And it's just a bummer when you know this is a story you love, and then they are like, yeah, but we're going to change it and not do any of the things that make it a story you love.
Yeah. Again, it feels like it's solely for the choice of doing something different and that there wasn't much more of a reason than that. Yeah, it's a shame because, again, this this movie has a lot going for it. I would have liked to have seen, and if it was fast track, that actually, you know, would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
With these kind of tonal differences and the fact that a lot of this stuff didn't really come together. It wasn't cohesive, I guess is probably the best term. And that would make sense if development was kind of rushed. There's two interesting movies in here, and if they had committed to either one of them, I think it would have been a really fun project or a really emotional, powerful project if either one of those movies had been committed to. So I would, for a King fan, I think I would recommend this just for those moments. I wouldn't say avoid it. Like you said, we've seen some much worse stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they definitely make Church look creepy. They make Ellie look creepy. They do a nice job visually of representing, you know, these characters on screen. And it's just the emotional impact that you don't have. And that is where it falls flat. And I try not to go on too long with the stuff that I don't enjoy, because I don't love being negative about things, but we did mention there were things that we did enjoy. There was a lot of potential with this movie that they just didn't hit on. And so, you know, I ended up dropping my rating down to a 2 out of 5 from a 3.5. I was like, I don't know what I was thinking the first time I watched this.
And, you know, and maybe that's the thing. This might be a movie that works well the first time, but doesn't play on subsequent views because you start noticing the cracks.
Yeah, that could be too.
I'd probably say the same. I'd probably say 2 out of 5. It's not a bad movie by any means. You know, I hope even with what we've complained about, that nobody listening thinks like, oh, this is just a stinker. Like, it just shows you potential that it never attempts to reach.
Exactly. So, you know, I think we can go ahead and wrap up on that note, because I really don't have too terribly much to say about this one. I think anyone who has watched it might feel the same way who is listening to this as well. And you know what? If you love this, I love that for you. I am not one of those people who's like, I don't like this, so no one can like it. You know, I just have, you know, a personal preference. And if I were to rewatch another Pet Sematary movie, it would not be this one. It would definitely be the 89 one.
Yeah, actually talking about this, I just scribbled a little note to myself that's going on my Halloween viewing for this year is the 89 version. And, you know, this movie might play completely differently to somebody who hasn't read the book either.
Absolutely. And I think because of the fact that it's one of my favorite King books, and I love the ending so much, this one just didn't come across as well for me. And, you know, I probably won't be putting any Stephen King stuff on my October watch list, just because...
I would imagine.
By the time everyone is listening to this, I have finished watching all of the current stuff. So I've finished watching everything through Chapelwaite. I have finished reading everything through Billy Summers. I do have his Humble Bundle short story to read, which I've been told only takes like 10 or 20 minutes. It's something that's really short. I am, you know, as caught up as I was planning to be by now. And I am going to, you know, consume the comics, which, Brad, you'll be joining me for some more Patreon episodes on the comics. And I think that's about all of the Stephen King I will be consuming for the next 3 months, give or take.
I imagine after that, you'll probably take a very long break before dealing with anything King related.
He doesn't have another book coming out until February. So I think, you know, the comics are easy enough to read to where I'm like, okay, I can handle reading one or two of those a week or something, because they aren't super long. They're not super time consuming. But, you know, reading a Stephen King book and watching something like, you know, a 10 episode season of Castle Rock or 9 episodes of The Stand, it takes up a lot of time, way more time than comics.
I tell you, the next thing I'm excited about King related is the new Salem's Lot feature film, which probably won't hit theaters until 2023, I imagine, but that I'm really excited about.
Yeah, it's funny because, just, you know, a quick side note here, since this episode isn't too long, I feel okay doing this at the end here, but it feels like there's not a whole lot coming all that soon, because we have Chapel Wait, which at the time of everyone listening to this is airing on Epix, and it feels like nothing concrete has been announced for 2022 aside from the third Gwendy's book. And I'm a little surprised by that as far as adaptations go. Maybe I just missed something, but it seems like everything kind of got stuck in the works during the pandemic, aside from Chapel Wait. That was like the one thing that was able to finish, along with Lisey's story, I would imagine, for Apple TV Plus. But yeah, it's kind of odd that, you know, we're in a little bit of a lull right now.
Yeah, everyone, you know, I work in the film industry, and kind of the, you know, the general consensus has been that starting in probably like the first quarter of 2022, we're going to have basically a big black hole where content normally would have been, you know, and some things will get shuffled around and they'll find ways to fill it. But all the productions that had originally been planned to be coming out, you know, this fall, in the spring of 2022, the summer of 2022, those are the things that got hit the hardest by the pandemic, and they all got pushed back. And so, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. There's a kind of a fear there might be, you know, a return to a lot of reality television, like there was, you know, around 2007 to fill that hole. But me personally, I would love to see more Stephen King stuff come in and fill that hole.
Yeah, I mean, we could possibly get Salem's Lot next year. It just depends. I know they've been doing a lot of casting, but almost everything is just TBA, 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 you know? So we'll see if anything comes up, like, you know, the Institute show, or I don't know, one of the 800 movies that's in the works, like Edgar Wright's The Running Man or something like that. Who knows? We'll see. I'm not super confident that we're going to get a ton of announcements by the end of this year. I know we've been seeing some casting stuff for Salem's Lot again, but yeah, that is something to look forward to, though. I'm all for a little bit of a break here, but Brad, thank you so much for joining me to talk about Pet Sematary. Wasn't great, wasn't the worst thing we've talked about.
Yeah, visually, check it out for Halloween. The masks, the cemetery, it's got a cool Halloween vibe. I'll definitely say that.
Totally fair. Before we go, I want to give a shout out to Mark Davitt, who became a loyal listener supporter on Patreon. Thank you so much, Mark. All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Sematary. You can support the show on Patreon for $1 a month. You get access to all of the bonus content. For $2 a month, you get that same access, plus a shout out on the show. And for $5 a month, you get all of those things, plus access to my Discord community, where you can talk to myself, guests, and other Patreon supporters. If you want to follow the show, you can do so at Chat Sematary on Twitter and Instagram. And thank you all for listening.